have my best creative moments when I'm by a body of water. It's, but ultimately everybody understands these things. Mm. And it's, I have no question, it's just a matter of time for how soon Portland really gets some steam and keeps this going. I mean, I never thought we would get this far in 5 years, to be honest with you. I mean, a conversation about a beach.
Oh, you say that now.
a conversation about a beach, like, I literally thought this was 5 years away in terms of city buy-in. So it's awesome. I mean, and there's no telling how quickly it will happen.
Right on.
It's all awesome.
We're going to have to leave this show there. I want to thank our guests, Will Levinson of the Human Access Project and Karen Bishop, Oregon Public Health Authority. Quick like a bunny, give us those website addresses again, Will.
TheBigFloat.com. HumanAccessProject.com, HumanAccessProject.com, HumanAccessProject on Facebook, like our Facebook page, and get into the water. Make a difference simply by getting in the water.
And if anybody wants to go to Oregon Health Authority's website, it is healthoregon.org/EHAP
to ask y'all for help in your situation. Right. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Sugar water.
Hey, good morning. It's 9 a.m. It is 9:45, and you have it tuned, KBOO Portland, and yes, Political Perspectives is up next. Kathleen Stevenson hosts. Her guest is activist Ai-Jen Poo, talking about her new book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. At 9:30, Don Merrill will be here. He's going to interview Martin Ford, the author of Rise of the Robots. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll hear the full hour of Flashpoints. Then at 11 on the Radio Zine, Kathleen Stevenson talks with Charles Fishman, author of The Big Thirst, Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, about how water has shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping the future. At 11:30, we hear an episode of the Scholars Circle with host Maria Armudian. And then we want to thank you for listening to KBOO. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a film screening of COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. COINTELPRO 101 is a one-hour documentary produced by the Freedom Archives explaining an illegal FBI program coined as the Counterintelligence Program, spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, that targeted revolutionaries of the 60s and 70s. There will also be a presentation of ongoing local work and Q&A session after the film. Again, that's COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. My guest is Ai-Jen Poo. She is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of the Caring Across Generations campaign. Her new book is The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America, published by the New Press. Ai-Jen Poo has been organizing immigrant women workers since 1996. In 2000, she co-founded Domestic Workers United, the New York organization that spearheaded the successful passage of the state's historic Domestic Workers Bill, Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, in 2010. Ai-Jen Poo has won numerous awards, including a 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant. She joins us by phone from Chicago. Ai-Jen Poo, thank you very much for being with us on KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Your book, The Age of Dignity, looks at the upcoming elder boom and our inadequate system of caring for our loved ones. You also put forth a plan to address the needs in this area for both the caregivers and those being cared for and their families. How did you become interested in this need for a holistic approach to caregiving?
Well, first of all, I've spent the last almost 20 years working alongside women who do family care work as their profession, whether it's child care as nannies or elder care as caregivers. And I've just seen the tremendous love and skill and hard work and energy that goes into that work. And yet, I mean, it's arguably some of the most important work in our economy, caring for the most precious elements of our lives. And yet it's so undervalued. It's some of the lowest paid work and most isolated and vulnerable. It's not even recognized as real work oftentimes. And so, you know, that contradiction to me of just knowing, and our members who do this work, the women who do domestic work, actually know the inherent value of that work. And so it is a tremendous disconnect when the work is so undervalued. And then on the other hand, I grew up with my grandparents living in my home with me. I had the great fortune of living in a multi-generational household where grandparents played a huge role in raising my sister and I. And as they grew older, I realized that they needed care and our family wasn't prepared for the care that they needed. And so my grandfather ultimately at the very end of his life had to be placed in a nursing home against his wishes. And all he wanted was to be able to stay at home with us, connected to family. And he passed away after 3 short months in that facility. And I just knew he wasn't sleeping, he wasn't eating. And that was not the way that our family wanted for him to spend his final days. And so between the just lack of real choices, affordable caregiving options for families and elders like my grandfather, and the incredible way in which this workforce that we're counting on to care for the people we love are so undervalued, they can't even sustain in their own jobs, and they can't even take care of their own loved ones, that there had to be an opportunity there for us to come together and create the win-win solution that could both improve these jobs and make them more sustainable, dignified jobs for the future, and create more care choices for our families. I mean, isn't that what we all want? So that was the origin of it.
And you mentioned some of the aspects of the caregiving job, isolation and other things that make it really difficult. Can you expand on that a little bit, just what it's like for a caregiver often?
Sure. Well, one example is a woman I write about in my book. Her name is Mirla Baldonado, and she's a caregiver in Chicago and has cared for over 20 elders and helps them live independently. She works 24-hour shifts 4 days a week and does everything from all the, they call them activities of daily living, so the bathing, eating, clothing, getting people in and out of bed, moving people in and out of the bath or the shower, making sure that their homes are clean, making sure that they're getting the right nutrition, monitoring and administering medication, monitoring heart rate and blood sugar levels, so helping people manage chronic illnesses as well, and allowing for people to stay home in a familiar environment, connected to community in a familiar surrounding. And it's oftentimes it can be round the clock, and you know, for people who have cared for family members with Alzheimer's, you know that it can be also a very unpredictable job and unpredictable circumstances, and oftentimes very emotionally as well as physically taxing.
Who are the people who are the caregivers of the elderly in America?
It's vast majority women. More than 90% of the professional caregiving workforce is women. And it's a very diverse a cross-section of American women. We have a lot of immigrant women and even undocumented immigrant women, and they will be a huge part of the caregiving solution for the future. And there are African American women and native-born white women who, many of whom are caring for family members and many of whom do this as a profession. And so it's a diverse cross-section and reflection of who we are as a country. And it's a workforce that touches all of us.
How are the caregivers usually or generally compensated in the U.S.?
It's all over the map. Some people are paid through private agencies. Some people are paid directly by individual households. And some people are paid through publicly funded programs like Medicaid. Now, one of the big misconceptions that we have in this country is that Medicare covers long-term care, and it does not. In fact, the two ways, essentially the two choices, which aren't really choices or certainly don't feel like it, for how one might receive long-term care is, one, if you're completely impoverished, meaning you have no assets whatsoever, you could be eligible for Medicaid. And oftentimes, Medicaid only covers or is very limited to institution-based or nursing home-based care, or it's overly weighted towards nursing home care. And if you're very, very wealthy, on the other end of the income spectrum, you might be able to afford long-term care insurance. And even when you can afford long-term care insurance, oftentimes it doesn't cover what you need when you need it. And so I've heard so many stories of people who've paid very expensive premiums, and then when they've actually needed home care, what they get covered is incredibly limited and not what they need. And so the truth of the matter is we have no plan. We have no system or infrastructure in place for the millions of us, everyday working families, who have loved ones who are going to need care. 27 million people are going to need care by the year 2050, and we don't have a plan in place. And I actually believe that that's a tremendous opportunity to address long-standing gaps in our safety net, to really meet 21st century family care needs in a way that is ambitious and rises to this moment, to not only address a crisis, but actually think forward, think in the future about what we need to actually thrive and live well in the future, as opposed to just get by.
I'm speaking with Ai Jen Poo. We are talking about her new book, The Age of Dignity. Why do you think that caregiving is so undervalued in our culture?
Well, there's lots of reasons. One is that I think our culture is generally fearful of aging and dying. We have not yet come to a place of acceptance that aging and dying are natural parts of life, with their own joys and complexities and beauty, like every other stage of life. And so we generally avoid or deny the fact that we are aging, and that actually limits what we can, the kinds of joys that can come from these stages of life if we actually have a plan and are prepared and accept. So the avoidance of aging and dying is a major cultural barrier for us. The other barrier is really the failure to recognize and value the work that goes into caring for families, whether it's done as family caregivers or as professional caregivers. This energy, this life force that gives us all so much and makes everything else possible, has been made invisible in our society. It's just assumed oftentimes that women will do it, right? Family members, daughters, and granddaughters. And we just simply, we're at a stage in our history where we cannot afford to not account for caregiving in a different way, to really understand its value and account for what we'll need in terms of that energy and work to care for our families.
One of the things you just mentioned was the need for, I think you mentioned three kinds of shifts that need to happen, and one being the cultural shift. What is the behavior shift that you see that needs to happen?
Well, I think we need to start thinking about and preparing for having conversations within our families. One of the things that I've been doing on my book tour is really encouraging families to have a simple conversation. Just get the conversation started at the dinner table with two simple questions. One being, how do we as a family prepare for our future caregiving needs? And it could be across the generational spectrum. It could be child care, elder care, and make it a family multi-generational conversation and project. And then the second question being, what do we imagine could be the joys of planning and caring for one another? And I think that it has the potential to really bring families together. Now, never are these conversations simple or complex or easy, but they are, when you have them from a place of preparation and foresight and planning as opposed to crisis, it can create a whole different level of possibility for families. And so one thing we have to do is have the conversation, and we have to start preparing, saving, planning. But really, everything that we could do as individuals and as families may not be enough. And when I think about the 27 million of us who are going to need care and the 100 million of us who are going to be directly affected by someone we love needing care, that we really do need a public conversation about how we tackle this issue as a public policy priority, as a market priority in terms of how business is going to come together and support families on this, and one where it's kind of an all hands on deck. I mean, I do believe that care can and should bring us together as a country so that we can figure out what it will take for us all to thrive as we live longer in the 21st century.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and I'm speaking with Ajahn Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of the Caring Across Generations campaign. We are talking about her new book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. There's a wonderful quote from Rosalind Carter that you start one of your chapters with in the book, The Age of Dignity, about caregivers. And anyway, I don't have it right at my fingertips right now.
She says so wisely, she says, there's only four kinds of people in the world: people who are caregivers or will be caregivers, people who need care or will need care. And oftentimes, it's been my observation that we're occupying more than one of those roles at any given moment. People who are receiving care are always caring as well, and the other way around. And that is, it is something that is a tremendous source of power and inspiration for me as I think about what it will take to really address these issues for the future when so many of us are directly affected. We do have the ability. It is within our reach to address the situation.
Let's talk a little bit about public policy. Are there good models of public policy around this issue in other countries?
Many other countries, particularly wealthy nations or developed first world nations, have universal long-term care as part of their social contract. So Germany has universal long-term care, Japan has universal long-term care, and these are two countries that started grappling with the impact of the elder boom or the age wave earlier on. Their demographic shift started happening sooner than ours, and so they are in many ways a generation or so ahead of us on really understanding and testing solutions. And there's been really innovative aspects of those solutions. In Japan, they've developed something called the caring relationship tickets, which is essentially a time banking system where you can, as a neighbor, go and provide care and support for a neighbor in your community and bank those hours so that some neighbor living next to your mother on the other side of the country, so that you can then actually get that care delivered for your mother who lives far away by a neighbor in her community. And that kind of care exchange has actually saved the Japanese healthcare system billions of dollars. And it's a way for neighbors to really show up for other neighbors. And I think we're going to have to be developing those kind of community-based solutions as well.
Yeah, sometimes it seems overwhelming, for instance, to be able to give caregivers a fair wage. And I think in your book you recommend that they get at least $15 an hour. And then if a family has to pay that much out of their pocket, that's pretty overwhelming for, say, 24-hour care for someone.
You know, it is overwhelming, and especially for everyday working families. But the truth of the matter is we're paying enormously for long-term care as it stands, whether it's through agencies whose business model is overcharge families, underpay workers, right? Or through institutions, the average private room stay in a nursing home is $87,000 per year. And I've been to some states on my book tour where people have said, oh no, in this state, the average is $120,000 a year. And so whether Medicaid is paying for that or whether we're paying for it out of pocket or some combination of the two, it is absolutely costly already. And it has been proven and tested. There's a lot of data to show that home and community-based care and services are incredibly cost-efficient and effective vis-a-vis institution-based care. So how we bring care home is going to actually make the material difference for everyday working families when it comes to not only affording care, but also quality of life for the people we love.
And you say that 90% of Americans want to stay in their homes as they age.
Isn't that something we all agree? We all agree that we want to be at home.
Right. And so what are some of the things, you lay out a lot of good recommendations for how policy issues and various aspects of policy can change, including, you know, Social Security and others. What are some of the things that would need to happen to make this kind of new way of dealing with long-term care happen?
Well, one, I think that states are in a really good position to take the lead, just like Massachusetts and other states really jumped ahead on health care. I think we can look to states like Hawaii, who are considering adopting a long-term care social insurance fund that people pay into their whole lives that allows them to draw from that fund to cover the cost of long-term care when they need it for up to 365 days. So, you know, the states are really taking the lead, and it makes sense because some states are aging very, very quickly. Maine, which is the oldest state in the nation, has a statewide plan called Keep Maine Home, which is really about preparing the state for home and community-based care for the growing elder population in the state. And it includes everything from new transportation accessibility to higher wages for caregivers to really try to sustain a strong caregiving workforce in the state. So states are leading the way. And we're really looking to leadership from the federal government. We're heading into a very important election year, and we want to make sure that all of the candidates hear from us that this is something we want them to address. They can't deny or hide from the fact that 27 million Americans are going to need care and 100 million of us are going to be impacted by the need for care. We're going to need to come together and really call upon all of our elected leaders and anyone who wants to be a leader in this country to have solutions ready for us, to present a plan so that we can respond and improve upon it.
There's something called the PACE model. Can you talk about that?
The PACE model is a model, an innovative healthcare delivery model that really is directed at trying to integrate home and community-based care into the broader healthcare system for our seniors. And so it's a patient-centered model where doctors, nurses, home care workers, and family caregivers really work together to ensure that an elder is having a very holistic and integrated set of services delivered, and that the home is really where all of that care is anchored. And it's been very successful with great outcomes, and it is the kind of example of what we need to be investing in the future. And it does take resources to set up, but we've now seen it in existence for long enough that we can actually start to see the ways in which we're saving enormous costs in the healthcare system by making that initial investment. And that's what this is this is a down payment on a better quality of life, not only for our seniors, but for working parents who are struggling to manage the cost of care for their elder loved ones and for their children. And it is not viable in the 21st century to do it alone. And so this is the kind of investment we need to be making on a more productive working population, adult working population, a better quality of life for working people and our elders, and good jobs in the caregiving sector for the future. So it's a kind of win-win-win. It requires an investment on the front end, but the outcomes and the cost efficiencies on the back end are unmistakable, unarguable.
Your group won a great victory in 2010, I believe, mm-hmm. with the passage of the New York Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. Can you talk about how that was accomplished and how it relates to accomplishing the kinds of things that you're talking about in this interview?
Absolutely. In New York, we were successful in passing the very first Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which is legislation to really bring the workforce that works in the private home, including caregivers, out of the shadows and into recognition and inclusion, full inclusion in labor laws. A lot of people don't realize that many of the people who work in the private home as professionals, whether they're cleaning or caring for children or caring for elders, are excluded from most of our basic labor protections. And there's a long history of why that happened that has to do with race and racism in our labor laws. But we were able to not only reverse those exclusions, but actually create some new protections for domestic workers in New York. And many states have followed after that since 2010. And the key to that was really lifting up the value of this work, the dignity of the work, and the fact that these are professionals, and really raising awareness that there are hundreds of thousands of homes in the state of New York that are, yes, they're private homes where people live, but they're also somebody's workplace. And those women rely on those paychecks to support their families, to pay their rent, to pay their bills. They've got to make ends meet too. And not only that, but they're a huge and growing part of our workforce. Caregivers, home care workers, are the single fastest growing occupation in the nation because of the huge need. And so for us to continue to ignore and invisibilize this work does not make any sense. And a lot of families joined in this fight, and you know, everyone from working moms who count on nannies to be able to go to work every day to, you know, sons who are caring for mothers with Alzheimer's and who count on a home care worker or a caregiver to make sure that they can go to work every day. And so a lot of people from all walks of life joined with us and said, yes, we need this work to be valued, and it's actually in all of our interests to make sure that we have a strong workforce for the future in our homes. And that is the principle through which we started the Caring Across Generations movement, which is our multi-generational, it's a national multi-generational movement to bring dignity to the work that goes into caring for our elders and to the quality of life that our elders are able to enjoy as they grow older. And it's about bringing all of us together to create real, affordable care choices and quality care jobs for the future.
How would someone get involved in that movement?
You can sign up, and people are signing up every day at www.caringacross.org. And you can learn more about the book and the book tour at caringacrossamerica.com. Please do sign up. We need you. We need your voices.
Ajahn Poo, I thank you so much for speaking with us on KBOO Portland.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. I have been speaking with Ajahn Poo, Director of the Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of the Caring Across Generations campaign. We've been talking about her book, The Age of Dignity, Preparing for the Elder Boom in a Changing America. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 15th Annual Village Building Convergence, May 29th to June 7th, all over Portland. Each day of the convergence, at over 40 sites all around the city, people will create community spaces that feature public art, gathering places, permaculture gardens, and natural buildings. In the evening, there will be speakers, community gathering, and music. The six evenings of events are all held at St. David's Community Center at 2800 Southeast Harrison Street in Portland. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, happening May 29th through June 7th, all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Don Merrill with Political Perspectives, and I'm talking with Martin Ford. Mr. Ford is the author of Lights in the Tunnel, Automation Accelerating Technology in the Economy.